Next up on This Week in Law, musician and lawyer Ali Sternberg joins us. Mike and Emery are both here with me. I'm Denise Howell. We're going to talk about Apple, Spotify, Tidal, legal issues concerning the streaming services. We'll talk about Led Zeppelin's case against Spirit, which it won. We'll talk about unintended consequences of Taylor Swift and others' withdrawal from services like Spotify. We'll take a quick look at Hillary's technology and innovation platform. That and much more on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Emery Roan, and Mike Keyes. Episode 351, recorded July 8th, 2016. Stairway to Court. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Blue Apron. Blue Apron will send you fresh, high-quality ingredients to cook delicious meals with simple step-by-step instructions right to your door. See what's on the menu this week and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/twit. That's blueapron.com/twit. And by Wealthfront. Wealthfront is a low-cost automated investment service and the most sophisticated way to invest your money. Whether you've got millions or you're just starting out, visit wealthfront.com/twill and sign up to get your free personalized investment portfolio. That's wealthfront.com/twill. And by FreshBooks, the super simple cloud accounting software that's giving thousands of freelancers and small businesses the tools to save time billing and get paid faster. Try it free at freshbooks.com/twill. Hi, folks. Denise Howell here. Welcome back to This Week in Law. We are so thrilled that you've joined us this week. We've had a couple of week breaks, so hence we're very excited, refreshed, ready to tell stories about what we did on our summer vacation. but before we get to any of that, let me introduce you to my two wonderful co-hosts and our panelists for the week. The two wonderful co-hosts, if you're joining us via video, you're seeing right now, they are, in order that you're looking at them, Emery Roan. He is a law student at California Western School of Law, an intern of many hats, including here at This Week in Law. And we're thrilled to see you again, Emery. Great to be back doing the show with you.
Thanks for having me back. Glad to be here. It's been a great little two-week break. I am ready to get into the legal weeds.
I know, me as well. But not before we introduce you or reintroduce you to Mike Keyes, my other co-host. He's a partner at Dorsey & Whitney in Seattle, co-author of their the TMCA blog. Hello, Mike.
Hello, Denise, and hello, Emery. Great to be with you all again. Missed you over the last couple of weeks.
I know. We missed you, too. We missed you on the show we did right before we took a break, which turns out to be sort of chillingly timely, given the events of the last 24 hours. In case you missed that show, episode 350 of This Week in Law was all about autonomous weapons systems. So if you have a renewed interest in that topic, you may want to go back and listen to that show. Our show this week is going to focus on music issues, and we have a great person to help us do that because she is a singer, songwriter, and a lawyer, and a returning panelist to This Week in Law. Ali Sternberg is with us again. Hello, Ali.
Hi, Denise and Emery and Mike. It's great to be back on This Week in Law, and definitely talking about music and law separately and together is an issue I love to talk about. So thank you for having me.
Wonderful to have you back. A reminder, in case your memory is rusty as to what Ali does when she's not here doing the show with us, she is policy counsel for the Computer and Communications Industry Association. She's a blogger at Project Disco. Do you call it Project Disco or the Disco Project?
We use them both. It's a kind of confusing branding. I just say Disco.
It's at Disco. It's a wonderful blog that goes along with the CCIA. She's a fellow at the Internet Law and Policy Foundry, and as I mentioned, a singer and songwriter in her own right. So she's got skin in the game when we talk about these music issues, which is what we're going to talk about for most of the show. So let's get right into it. All right. We've had a couple of interesting legal decisions that it's wonderful to be able to discuss with someone like Allie. Let's start out with Led Zeppelin. If you can start out with Led Zeppelin, it's always a good thing to do. We've talked before about their dispute with a band called Spirit and the famous riff that begins both a Spirit song and Stairway to Heaven. We can set the stage for this discussion by having you do a little compare and contrast on your own of the music that was at issue in this lawsuit that was recently decided. So there we have the plaintiff.
Plaintiff's estate.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
As it often is. Mm-hmm. Mm. See why just based on the music that you'd have something to talk about with Stairway to Heaven here. But it's not just based on the music, or the lawsuit wasn't just based on the music. It was based on various other facts that came into play when the bands were on tour together. Mike, you did a great post on this on the TMCA. Tell us what happened in the case and give us some further background.
Sure. So you just played the clip from the song Taurus, written by this band Spirit. It was written back in the, as I recall, in the late 60s. Ultimately, Randy California, the alleged owner of the copyright in Taurus, his estate sued Led Zeppelin a couple of years ago, claiming that the iconic Stairway to Heaven rock anthem, one of the most popular pieces of music in the history of rock and roll, infringed on that opening riff that you just played for our audience. So there was a lot of back and forth over the last couple of years regarding the allegations. Both sides moved for summary judgment. The motions were by and large denied, which resulted in a trial. It was a 6-day trial with a couple of days of deliberation by the jury. And ultimately, the jury came out and found that although Led Zeppelin had access to the plaintiff's work in question, the works were not substantially similar, which, of course, is the standard for infringement of copyright. There was a lot of interesting evidence, a lot of interesting arguments that were posited by both sides, but and one can, I guess, as we did at the TMCA, somewhat speculated as to why the jury came out the way it did, which in my opinion is the correct decision. But ultimately, the jury found that the songs weren't infringing, and plaintiff's counsel said, we're going to see an appeal here, so we'll see what happens.
So we've seen in recent years cases like this go the other way, where the similarities might not have even been quite as obvious as they are here. Do you have any thoughts or explanation as to why the courts, well, here we had a jury trial, so that could certainly factor in, but why we're seeing different kinds of results in these kinds of cases?
Well, it's a really good question. I mean, every jury obviously is different. The facts are different in every case. One thing, well, I'd say there's probably a couple of important factors to consider here. One, that clip that you just played, the audio clip mm-hmm. from the Spirit recording, is actually not the audio clip that was played to the jury. The jury heard a rendition of Taurus performed on a keyboard. So it didn't have the same guitar sound to it, the same orchestral sound that the sound recording does. So that was a big bone of contention. The plaintiff's lawyer was jumping up and down saying, hey, look, we essentially were forced to try this case in an alternate reality because the jury couldn't hear the actual sound recording. They were relegated to hearing, from the plaintiff's perspective, the keyboard rendition. So that was one thing that was a big argument of plaintiffs. Yes, Emery.
So I guess just for our listeners that might not be aware of the intricacies of that argument, could you, I guess, give a little bit of background of why they had to play it on the keyboard as opposed to playing the actual music recording?
Yeah, so I think there were really two different rationales for the court's decision in that regard. One, the registered work was the actual composition itself, the sheet music.
Right.
So that was one. Two, as I mentioned a few moments ago, this song was actually recorded initially back in 1968, which would have been prior to the date upon which sound recordings were protected under copyright. So I think those two factors came together and ultimately
copyright.
The court ruled that federal copyright. Thank you, Allie. Of course, sound recordings are protected under state law, under certain state laws. But in terms of federal copyright protection for sound recordings did not come into play until 1972. So I think those are really the two underlying rationales as to why the jury just was exposed to the keyboard rendition of Taurus as opposed to the full sound recording.
Yeah, and that's the kind of evidentiary decision by a judge that can really, as you point out, Mike, make a huge difference in the way the case goes. So
it did. I think the other point that I was going to mention, which is I think, you know, potentially as significant as the court's ruling with respect to what the jury heard, is the originality of this particular five-note bass line. There was significant evidence that this was not original. No offense to Randy California, the plaintiff, and frankly, no offense to Led Zeppelin either. But neither one of these parties originated this particular musical idea or musical phrase. As a matter of fact, as we blogged about at the TMCA, there's evidence showing that this particular bass line with the minor arpeggiated chords above it, that this actually originates as far back as the 1600s by a guitarist and composer by the name of Giovanni Battista from Italy. There's a recording that we linked to on YouTube that actually sounds very similar to both the Taurus and Stairway to Heaven recording. So, you know, you can also find this bass line in other more recent songs, popular songs. My Funny Valentine is a good one. Chim Chim Cheree from Mary Poppins has very similar chordal progression. So, you know, all of that comes together. And if you look at this, you say, well, geez, this isn't actually original to the plaintiff. Now, of course, we don't know what the jury ultimately relied on, but I can tell you that as a musician myself, and if I were a juror and I heard that evidence, I'd think, wow, that's pretty compelling for Led Zeppelin that it's this bass line isn't original to the plaintiff.
Can I throw this out to Ali and Mike, I guess, then? I know that one of the arguments, they analogized this to stock footage. Sort of, they said that, you know, a writer doesn't have a copyright on, you know, 'Twas a Dark and Stormy Night. How far do you think that analogy works for this type of chord progression? Is there obviously there's some point at which, you know, stock footage becomes unique and creative. Do you think that this case, I guess, provides any clarity on that? And do you think that the stock footage analogy is appropriate?
Allie, do you want to tackle that one?
Yeah. So the stock footage argument kind of makes, the way that you framed it kind of makes me think of copyright doctrines such as scent, which I always kind of pronounce wrong, scent affair, and just you can't really own a concept or a feel or a like a genre. I know that this kind of came up a lot in the Blurred Lines context, because a lot of that that copyright litigation similarly, the songs might have sounded similar for the sound recording, but what they were actually looking at in the composition, kind of like in this case, the when you're actually comparing the sheet music that was registered. So, yeah, the music, it can definitely be a relevant thing where people should not be able to own a whole genre. It's especially when music, we're all building on each other and what already exists. And there are definitely a lot of parts of music that can't be protected, if that gets at what you were getting at.
Do you agree with Mike, Allie, this was the right outcome here?
Yeah, I do. And I think that Mike's post was really helpful. And I think we're going to continue to see a lot of these cases. I think we have to look at two different types of cases. There's these sort of like copy. It sounds the same kind of copyright stuff. And then there's the actual where they might have sampled a portion of the song. And I think we're going to see a lot of these cases, especially with a lot of these older songs and often filed like these suits that are often filed by the estates and the heirs, because a few years ago there was the Supreme Court decided a Petrella case that declined to apply a latches argument, and so even though these there's a statute of limitations of 3 years in copyright, but the Supreme Court is basically saying that if the alleged infringement is ongoing, then they can still file the lawsuit as long as it's been happening for the last 3 years. So that's definitely seeming to contribute to a lot more of these cases being filed, even when some of these songs are so, both the song by the defendant and the plaintiff are so much older. So I don't think that this phenomenon of these kind of cases is going to be going away anytime soon.
And Ali, I think you raised a really interesting point about laches, because as I understand it from what happened at trial here, in plaintiff's opening statement, he mentioned something about how we're now able to bring this claim because there's been a change in the law, essentially referring to the Supreme Court's Petrella decision that said laches is no longer applicable or doesn't apply in the context of copyright infringement claims. But as a juror, I'm thinking, I'd look at that and kind of balancing the equities. I'm thinking to myself, why is this just being brought now, 40 years later, and the actual person that allegedly wrote the song isn't even here to testify? I know through no fault of his own, of course, but I think it just further underscores that, geez, this is 40 years after the fact, and you're essentially asking to rewrite rock history and say that this is an infringement of a rather obscure piece of music that was written back in the heydays of the 1960s. So I agree that we're probably going to see more of these types of cases, not only music infringement cases, but also copyright cases in general as a result of Petrella. But it still seems to me that there's a de facto type of a laches argument that, at least when a jury's looking at this, may think, you know, this just doesn't seem right. It doesn't seem fair that all these years later, you're now finally bringing this to court.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's not very, it's hard to be sympathetic to that. I do feel like some people reacted differently to the Blurred Lines case, but that might have been because comparatively the defendants weren't very sympathetic. So it's kind of, you never know what's going to convince a jury, whether they're going to be looking, caring more about the music or sometimes just the people themselves. And comparing Marvin Gaye with Robin Thicke, it's kind of not hard to see who to sympathize with sometimes on issues completely unrelated to music. So I can see how a lot of times a jury deciding these cases can lead to results that are more about emotions in addition to the complicated copyright law principles, when you have to look at the musical works and the sound recording and apply all the different tests. It can definitely be challenging for all kinds of people. And one thing I wanted to note was that my coworker pointed out that the same lawyer, Richard Bush, B-U-S-C-H, he represented Marvin Gaye in the Blurred Lines lawsuit. And he also represented Madonna, the defense, for a sampling case of around a horn sample in Madonna's Vogue. And he also represented Bridgeport in the Sixth Circuit a long time ago. So he kind of is on both sides of a circuit split, both as a plaintiff and defendant for a Sixth Circuit case and a Ninth Circuit case, which is very interesting and probably pretty rare. So it's I found that to be really a bunch of really interesting coincidences for this copyright lawyer.
Sure. One other point, you know, Ali, you mentioned that, you know, the complexity of these issues. As we mentioned at the outset, the jury found that, and I think this is kind of an interesting curiosity, which I think does kind of emphasize and underscore the complex nature of these types of claims. So the jury found that the defendants had access to the underlying work. But it's kind of curious that they found that, because the underlying work itself was the music composition, the sheet music. Mm-hmm. And so the jury found that there was access to it, yet as I understand it, there was never any evidence that there was access to that sheet music or that original composition. There was some evidence that they may have been exposed to the sound recording or the live performance by the band itself, but not the sheet music. So it is, you know, it shows kind of some of the issues. It can be a little bit murky and maybe a little bit hard to conceptualize for a jury when you're talking about, well, what does access mean in this particular context?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, that brings me, I often think about the George Harrison case, where he ultimately ended up losing, and they kind of called it like a unintentional copying, just like he might have heard the song. So like a lot of times access can be hard to prove, but if it's a popular song, they sometimes assume. But it's definitely an interesting phenomenon, especially when songs are so similar. I mean, in that case, it was like da 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 da. It's like a really, really simple part of a scale. So I can. Yeah, I really, as a musician, I can see how a lot of people might come up with a lot of the same chord progressions and the same melody when there's a finite number of notes and an even smaller number of notes that actually sound good. So in pop music, I can see why there's a lot of this phenomenon happening.
Mm-hmm. Ali, I have a question for you, sort of inspired by this discussion that's a little bit off in the weeds, but the way it's inspired by this discussion and inspired by Mike's blog post on the case is because I keep thinking about how somebody needs to do a mashup of Chim Chim Tree and what was the other song?
My Funny Valentine.
My Funny Valentine and Stairway to Heaven and Taurus and possibly this number from the 1600s, Mike, that somehow a sound recording exists of. And when they
sounds
do
like
so,
a
so here's... Yes, exactly. But my question for you, Ali, that it's sort of related, unrelated, is if someone were to do that mashup, I know this is not a mashup case, but the law on mashups continues to be turbulent and unsettled and uncertain. And if you were to do that mashup and release it commercially and try and monetize it, I don't know that you'd feel like you were on particularly solid legal grounds. I noticed in looking at your SoundCloud page, you've done a few mashups personally yourself. And I just wondered if you wanted to weigh in for our listeners and viewers on sort of the state of mashup law.
And someone in the chat has already provided a link to the mashup of My Funny Valentine and Stairway to Heaven.
Thanks, oh, yeah. Thank you so much. You. I know I love you all in IRC. That's brilliant. If you can cue that up, Victor, we'll play it. But what do you think, Ali? That mashup or another, how comfortable are you as the artist in that situation? The mashup artist?
No, of course. I will say that I have not gone through the process of trying to clear my mashups. I put them out under a Creative Commons license, and they're really bad quality and would not be a substitute for the original work. So, but I think that the law is probably pretty unsettled. A lot of these cases don't get litigated. A lot of the artists put their music out for free, which doesn't mean it's not infringing. But I think that but they're not getting, a lot of them, I haven't really heard of a case where a DJ is getting sued. There might be, sometimes you hear about DMC takedown notices or something like that because of an algorithm triggered it. But that doesn't mean anything about it actually being infringing or whether there could be an argument of fair use or de minimis use or other things like that. So I think the law is pretty unsettled, which hasn't seemed to really stifle it. I've heard a lot of great mashups and remixes from different DJs. And so I think that it's not, it doesn't seem to be stifling creativity in that field yet. I would be curious to see if there were different kinds of lawsuits, because I think, I used to write about Girl Talk. I don't even know if he's still making these mashups, but that he would sometimes talk about copyright and fair use and think that he had a pretty good argument, but no one's ever gone after his mashups, which use a lot of different sounds, a lot of different songs into one. I guess you'd have to look at ones that use like 25 different songs in the span of like 3 minutes. I like a lot of DJ Earworm does a really good compilation at the end of every year, where it puts together the top 25 songs and kind of shows how like there are a lot of repeated words and repeated melodies and chord progressions, and it fits together really nicely. I'm a big fan of those. I see someone else mentioned the Four Chords by Axis of Awesome. That shows how many songs have the 1-5-4-6 minor progression. But so I think the law is pretty unsettled, but I'm not sure it's a bad thing. I think that people are still making great, interesting music, and hopefully they're going to continue to do that. And I haven't put up any matchups in a while or other recordings, but I'm working on recording some original songs, and I want to do some more covers too. So I'm looking into getting a better microphone and doing awesome. Some more professional recording.
Fantastic. All right. Well, Victor has, with great alacrity, found the Funny Valentine Led Zeppelin mashup. We'll play it for you in a second. I want to first thank one of our sponsors for this episode of This Week in Law. Well-timed here in California because it's just about lunchtime, so I hope you're hungry. Blue Apron is one of our sponsors today. Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone while supporting a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs. Now, if you haven't tried Blue Apron yet, I can't tell you enough how much I love this service and how much I think you'll love this service. For all the reasons they just said, you're getting fresh, locally sourced ingredients delivered in sort of a just-in-time way. You're going to get them and hopefully use them right away. But you're very able to tailor, first of all, what you receive. They give you all kinds of choice in what meals you get every week. So if you like tacos but you don't like fish or whatever the case may be, you can definitely have a good deal of control over the selection process. And if you're going to be gone, like we just were from the show for a couple of weeks, you can certainly turn off the spigot and make sure that nothing is being delivered to your house that would go to waste. What I love about it the most is the way that it exposes our family to different cuisines and different ingredients working together well, good food mashups, if you will, that we might not have come up with on our own. I really love the inspiration that they add to our cooking that way. And I also really love the easy way that it engages everyone in the kitchen. You probably, if you live with several folks, have one person who's more inclined to do the cooking on a regular basis than someone else in the household. And Blue Apron makes it really easy and welcoming and fun for people who aren't the ordinary cook in your house to get involved and try their hand and really feel proud of what they've been able to accomplish, whether it's your kids or your spouse or your roommate or what have you. It's a really good adventure in the kitchen. Blue Apron sets the highest quality standards for their community of over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the United States. Seafood is sourced sustainably. Beef is raised humanely. Chickens are free range. Pork is raised naturally. And regenerative farming practices are used for produce. By shipping the exact amount required for the recipe, Blue Apron is reducing food waste. Whether it's Japanese ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, Blue Apron brings you the best. And seriously, having used the service for a while and recommended it to lots of people on the show and friends and family, the feedback that I always get from folks is they literally can't believe how good the quality of the food is, how fresh the ingredients are, and how delicious everything is. So you really have to try it yourself. New recipes are being created every week by Blue Apron's culinary team and are not repeated within a year, so you get great variety. You can cook meals like serrano pepper and goat cheese burgers with zucchini slaw, or fresh pappardelle pasta with summer tomato, olive ragu, and ricotta salata. And again, I don't even know what salata is, but if Blue Apron sent it to me, I would, because I would make it myself, and I assure you, whatever it is, it's delicious. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/twit. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. Visit blueapron.com/twit. Thank you so much, Blue Apron, for your support of This Week in Law. All right, as promised, let's do that mashup, Victor.
Your looks are laughable, unphotographable, but you're my favorite work of art.
I feel like I need a martini with this.
Maybe two.
I just feel like I need a martini.
Are you smart? But don't change your hair for me. Not if you care for me.
Come on, I'm sensing Zeppelin at any moment.
Are you gonna sing it? Come on.
I don't know. I haven't seen this. Come on, chat.
Here we go. That or we're going to get Rickrolled.
Skip ahead to what, Pete?
Yeah,
Chris
just that he's playing the same. I don't know if I would notice that.
Yeah, it might be time. Just his, really whatever he's got, the mandolin there, that he's playing the... Do 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 do. All right, well,
we might have to pull it back. We got some chat people nodding off.
I know. I think I'm nodding off too. The martini was too much coupled with that. But thank you, chat, for you can see the similarities in any event between the riffs there for sure. What were you going to say, Amory?
I have a sort of unrelated question inspired by the discussion we've had and by what I've heard in the chat. But someone brought up in chat a video of a mashup of like six different country songs that sounded largely identical. And I was just thinking that, you know, we see in certain genres, you know, there's definitely more of a trend to have more repetitive or duplicative sounding music. A lot of pop and country in particular sounds like that. Why... I don't know where the question I have coming off of this, but it feels like, why aren't we seeing any copyright complaints coming from those spheres when we see these blurred lines, and Stairway to Heaven, which doesn't sound nearly as, I think, the same.
You think country artists are just more Southern courteous in some way?
I doubt that, but I was wondering if, I don't know, the economic structure of how pop music is manufactured. I don't know. Obviously none of us are in the music biz, well, I guess actually Allie and Mike might be. So I figured if anyone knew anything, maybe you guys would, but maybe just someone in this chat is saying just some people are more litigious than others.
Any thoughts?
That could be. I mean, I don't fancy myself as an expert in country music at all, but yeah, it could very well be that when it comes to country music, the chord progressions, you know, not that they're all the same by any means, but there's kind of a similar pattern that's used in that particular style. And so it may not be really worth anybody's time, money, or effort to claim that there's infringement when, in fact, it's just endemic to that particular genre that certain chordal progressions are used. I don't know. Maybe Allie has some insight for us on that one.
Yeah, well, I would kind of contrast it with a lot of the – so not the Zeppelin case, but a lot of the sampling cases. There's a really famous sample of a drummer a drum sample that's in a lot of different hip hop songs. And so there's a bunch of different issues here throughout music history of often like studio session artists not really getting compensated. And then there's a lot of fairness issues, which might have to do more with contracts and business reasons than copyright reasons. But it's been a while since I can remember what book it might have been in, but there are a bunch of scholars who look at music and copyright, but also through more of like history and sociology and just how music's changed through culture and often ignoring what other, maybe a lot of like African-American artists might have been doing, and then all of a sudden it starts to get really popular and making money, and then they start to sue over sampling. And so a lot of times there's a lot of other cultural and racial and social issues at play too. And so that might help explain why we see a lot of litigation over that type of music. But it is interesting that in country music, where there might be a lot more similarity in the chord progressions and in just the acoustic sounds, maybe just no one's trying to own it because they would, you can't really own this, the progression or the sound. And so, yeah. And if someone tried to do it and like was like a country copyright troll, then they could go after a lot of artists. So I do hope that doesn't happen. And I know this, the sampling trolls are a major phenomenon, but I don't expect that to happen in the country. But it is a really interesting point. There's a lot of different reasons, some copyright, a lot not, that we don't see that happening in all types of music.
Country music is a nice illustration of how IP law does not extend far enough to protect the idea of singing about your truck, your dog, or the girl who done left you.
Somehow I feel like all three of those are the same thing in every country song.
No, the lyrics are another part where there's a lot of similarity. So that's a really interesting point.
Yeah. Well, we're going to put our first MCLE passphrase into this episode of This Week in Law. We put these phrases in case you are a lawyer or other professional who likes to listen to or watch the show for professional credit in your field. We have some people who do that for sure. So if you are a lawyer, you can head on over to wiki.twit.tv, find the This Week in Law page there, and we've got some information on how you might apply in your jurisdiction to get continuing legal education credit. Some jurisdictions like to have some concrete proof that you didn't just write episode 351 of This Week in Law down on a list and turn it in, but that you actually watched or listened to our rather lengthy shows. So we put these phrases in so we can kind of double check you on that. Our first phrase for this week will be to be a rock and not to roll, in honor of the great Led Zeppelin. Let us move on. Well, I'll let you guys pick the next topic. We have a bunch of music topics here. Mike, let's go to you. What would you like to discuss next?
Well, how about the DMCA issue that the artists have brought to Congress and I guess the Copyright Office?
Sure. Let's talk about it. That would be a legislative and policy issue that we may see law change if somebody responds to this letter that was brought to Congress urging changes in the DMCA. So just for chuckles, let's play our policy bumper. All right. I feel better. I feel somehow fulfilled. Mike, tell us about that. It's the RIAA and various artists have signed on to an open letter to Congress, the crux of which is wanting some changes in the DMCA to impose more burdens on third-party hosting services such as YouTube to filter as things are being uploaded, to detect infringement before it actually gets posted, as opposed to the way things currently worked, which is filtering happens afterwards and notifications and reporting happens afterwards and things get pulled down. Sometimes things that shouldn't be pulled down get pulled down. Any more you want to add about the letter or its impact, Mike?
Well, it's interesting in that at least the letter that I reviewed, you know, it is an open letter to Congress saying that there needs to be a recalibration of the DMCA, but I'm not sure that there were any suggestions as to how it needs to be retooled, just that it needs to be retooled. Mm-hmm. The letter also indicated that, look, this is kind of an antiquated copyright provision, which I think is interesting. And as was pointed out by one commentator, that, look, it's the DMCA is actually, you know, one of the most, if not most recent additions to the Copyright Act. So, you know, I suppose under that logic, the 1976 Act itself is antiquated and needs to be rehauled. But in any event, it's, you know, it does show this interesting tension that exists between content owners and those that are providing various online platforms where music and other content can be listened to and shared by consumers. It's a difficult balance. I think Congress has tried as best as it could back in 1998 to strike a balance between content right holders and the rights of technology providers, and trying to strike at least some sort of middle ground between allowing artistry and artists to still flourish and allowing technology to develop and allowing technology companies to innovate. So we'll see if anything comes of this. You know, copyright legislation historically has always been hammered out by various interest groups coming together and lobbying Congress and coming up with provisions that each side can live with, or in some cases that one particular side can live with and other sides can't live with. So any change that's going to be brought as a result will probably be slow in coming. But worth keeping an eye on to see what happens here.
Right. The thing about the DMCA, I mean, you can love it or hate it, but a lot of people love it or hate it, which kind of indicates to me that it's a law that's kind of doing its job. You know, it's definitely got some controversial aspects, but it's not serving any one master, I guess, is the point about it.
Kind of like kind of like the old saying by, I think it was Winston Churchill, that democracy is the worst form of government, but it's the best one we know of, or something to that effect, right? That,
right,
exactly. You know, the DMCA, it's not perfect, and I don't think anybody thinks it is perfect, but given the various and diverse legal interests at play, you know, it's maybe serving a very useful function.
Mm-hmm. Ali Disco did a really nice post about the letter. Can you kind of sum up their points for us and add anything else that's on your mind about this?
Yeah, absolutely. So Disco, you can find the link at project-disco.org. It's on the front page if you look for the DMCA, or I see it on the screen here too. So my colleague Matt wrote about the letter and kind of debunked some myths in it. And Mike mentioned one of them, which is that the complaints about it being out of date were interesting because it is one of the most recent major copyright overhauls. I mean, if you're looking at the DMCA, the most recent Copyright Act itself was in 1976, and a lot of that stuff has been around since 1909. So the 1998 is actually pretty recent, and Congress was very explicit in their legislative history about what their intents were with the DMCA. It was they limited liability in order to encourage the efficiency of the internet will continue to improve, and the variety and quality of services on the internet will continue to expand. And so they really were concerned with making sure that the internet would continue to grow. And that we have a few studies that we cite often that have showed that the certainty provided by the DMCA has really helped encourage the internet economy to really grow, because there's a balance inherent in Section 512 safe harbors where the content creators and owners, they have a mechanism where they can get stuff taken down in an expeditious manner by when they submit a takedown and in return. And then the services, they have some certainty that their liability will be limited if they're complying with their part of the bargain, which is to take the stuff down expeditiously. And so it's really helped to encourage these really important platforms for creativity and for expression and democracy. And I think that DMCA is really working. And to look at the other points in the article, responding to the music industry letter, some other misconceptions about how the industry is actually doing economically, and some really kind of odd argument about how it was the tech companies that were being considered in 98 are different from the ones today, which is kind of not how when you make a law, that's not really how it works. I mean, it's great to have different companies that have grown that might not have existed when the law was written, but that still benefit from the important work that was done then. And so we think that the DMCA is working, but I do agree that people have, while we think it's working, there also can be a lot of abuse with it. Often people, it can be a really powerful tool to be able to send a takedown notice and get something taken off the internet, which people sometimes use against criticism. We've seen it used in political contexts sometimes. So it can definitely be a powerful tool for silencing speech, but it's also a really powerful tool for limiting infringement. And one other thing I'll respond to in that Mike had mentioned was that the letter doesn't seem to ask for much, but one thing that some people have interpreted the letter to suggest is that instead of the current notice and takedown regime, some people would like a notice and stay down regime, which would really, really fundamentally change the balance of the burdens in the DMCA. And in fact, several services have gone really above and beyond in implementing these kind of algorithms such as Content ID on YouTube or Audible Magic that a bunch of other services use. And that kind of, that's a tool that can kind of prevent stuff from being uploaded because the audio is matched against it. But they're doing what above and beyond what they're required to do under Section 512 of the DMCA. But there's also been some interesting research that shows that in the beginning, when these kind of tools were introduced, a lot of the art, content owners would choose to block things. And then as time goes on, they've often gone towards keeping things up, but putting an ad in front of it and monetizing it. And there's research that shows that about half of artists' revenue, maybe half comes from their own stuff and half comes from leaving other people's mashups and remixes and stuff that has their audio in the background up and just monetizing it, but choosing not to take it off the internet. So there's a lot of, it's definitely a complicated issue. As I think our resident DC person, I don't foresee this changing anytime soon. It's a really controversial issue that a lot of people care about from the content side, tech side, and really importantly, the public interest side. So I don't foresee this changing anytime soon, but it was a pretty notable thing to have all these music industry interests send out this letter in a really prominent way. So I'm glad that we were able to flag it, and I definitely encourage people to check out my coworker's post on the Disco blog for more information.
Hmm. Yeah, I think that the DMCA is so interesting because it's something that is so frequently, I think, misunderstood by the end mm-hmm. users that really rely on it. So I know that, you know, YouTube has been an ongoing controversy on YouTube has been the way that YouTube is or that videos can get taken down on YouTube due to copyright infringement letters. And this is, of course, you know, Google and YouTube responding affirmatively to the obligations placed on them by the DMCA that allow them to have this service. But most people, I think most end users don't really get that there is that connection between the reason YouTube is allowed to exist is because we have this system that lets people submit takedown letters, at least partially. So I think that that's, you know, one of the misconceptions that I think the DMCA carries with it is number two that was brought up in the letter that the RIAA and their it's the right word, not compatriots. And they're, you know, the people they represent brought up was that, I'm quoting from it, music consumption is skyrocketed, but the monies earned by individual writers and artists for that consumption has plummeted. Now, that's a misconception that your coworker brought up in the letter. But mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could, I guess, talk on that. If you had anything to add, I guess, about that sort of disconnect.
Yeah, so I think he gets at how maybe the money that's going to these individual middlemen that might have been reduced in some ways because people aren't buying CDs anymore. But there's really been a shift in how people consume music, and people pay for subscription streaming services, and people go to concerts, and people support fans in a lot of different ways. And looking at one individual revenue stream, just what streams are coming from Spotify or something, is kind of disingenuous. You have to, it's all the different pieces of the pie really do add up, and artists are, especially, and this is a lot of these, the people who are on this letter were some of the biggest names from now and from the past like half century. But I would expect that a lot of artists who might not be on a major label and might not have a lot of these different big labels and publishers taking such a big cut, if they're doing more, they're putting their stuff out by themselves online, they might have a different feeling about how the internet is helping them reach fans and helping them create music and how they're making more than they could have in a totally different era when they didn't have as much autonomy and control and ability to make and produce music. So yeah, I do think that it's definitely a different argument coming from like the 1% of the artists, the top 1%. And I do think that, yeah, that there are stats that showing that the shift in music consumption and it is going a lot more towards streaming and towards touring and all kinds of other revenue streams besides just recorded music, which for so long was the main way that musicians made a living. So yeah, it is really just looking at it really narrowly when it's a lot more complicated than that, as it often is.
But I guess my point that the DMCA not only allows for these services to exist, but it also allows for these artists to exist in a lot of ways too. I guess I feel like there's this fundamental disconnect that people don't seem to realize the DMCA actually helps them too. It's not just the way that their stuff is taken down.
Absolutely. Right. Getting back to Mike's Churchill quote about the system you have may not be perfect, but it's the best one you have. In a perfect world, I would love for Congress to be able to revisit a law written in 1998 and update it, tweak it slightly, make it more friendly for all concerned, for the concerns of 2016 and beyond. But I don't have a whole lot of faith that that can happen. You know, partisan system.
That's where things like, you know, the TPP come in, right? I mean, if I'm not mistaken, Ali certainly knows better than I about this. But I think that part of that onerous, you know, notice and stay down provision, I think, is part of the TPP, or at least was certainly pushed for it. Do you know anything about that, Ali?
I've heard some allegations about that, as I think is also addressed in Matt's post, that a lot of what they were complaining about, it, a lot of like these regimes have been pushed. So the U.S. exports a lot of its copyright law, and so trying to change the DMCA safe harbors would also make the U.S. Could mean that they're not complying with these obligations that they've encouraged all these other countries to have. One thing I will note that's new in the TPP this time is that for the first time, there is some important language about copyright balance, and it's encouraging not just these liability limitations, but also there's language about fair use for this first time, because one of the most important things about our copyright system is its balance in the U.S. is that we have these First Amendment protections and often. Found in fair use, as the Supreme Court has discussed in the Golan and Eldred cases. So it is really important that for the first time, we are also attempting to encourage other countries to adopt provisions about this balance. I have heard that about notice and stay down I'm not as up to speed on that, but I wouldn't think that we would be changing, exporting something that we're not currently in compliance with. So I'm not sure. I know there were a lot of leaks. I don't follow the trade stuff as much, but I don't think we're expanding the changing the 512 safe harbors through the TPP, but don't quote me on that.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's going to pass.
But we all understand what you mean when you say that it would be a much more onerous world for service providers in a notice and stay down regime, but maybe we should make that explicit for people who are watching and listening why that's the case, why it's not just trivially easy to make sure things stay down.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, it would affect services, and it would really affect the consuming public, too. But it's almost hard, like, it's hard enough as it is to comply with the DMCA protections as they are. They really do put a lot of burdens, and it can be we talked about this a little bit there in our comments to the Copyright Office a few weeks ago. So the Copyright Office was looking at, they reopened some regulations that they were examining from 2011 about changing the fee to when you designate the agent who receives the DMCA takedowns. And they just kind of threw something in a footnote that said that you'd have to renew every 3 years. And so they were only a few groups ended up submitting comments this time. So we'll see if anything actually ends up changing in that. But the DMCA compliance burdens as they are can be really challenging, especially for smaller services and for startups looking to get into the music space or something as it is. But so if you have to implement a stay-down regime, that could be a lot more complicated. The algorithms or the different kinds of technical compliance you'd have to do to build that in would definitely be a lot more challenging. And so it's a lot easier to comply with the notice and takedown that when you receive a compliant notice that satisfies the 512 regulations, then you take it down. That's a lot easier to implement than having to set up a whole technologically complex filtering system that prevents something from being re-uploaded. I think that, it would be a large burden on the services, and it could really potentially stifle some important fair use kind of uploads that are done by members of the public. So it would be a really big change for services and for users.
Mike, were you going to add something?
Oh, I was just going to ask Allie for her thoughts on whether this letter was driven in part by the Ninth Circuit decision in Lens, which requires fair use to be considered as part of the takedown notice. Do you think that came into play at all?
That's an interesting thought. That hadn't occurred to me. Something that Matt mentioned in the post was that the complaints might be tied to renegotiating certain licenses or certain contracts with YouTube and possibly other streaming services. So it could have been like kind of more business oriented and trying to show the power they can exert. But that is an interesting point about the Lens case, which is still ongoing. I think both sides ended up appealing for different reasons. So I am kind of curious to see how that case continues. I went to the Ninth Circuit oral argument last year, I think. So yeah, it's definitely an important and really interesting case that's been going on for so long. The dancing baby is now like 16. So that is a really interesting point. There are a lot of different things intersect in this context. And yeah, I having to consider fair use would be, could be really interesting impact on both services and creators.
Yeah. As long as we're talking policy, I think this is a logical place to mention that we have recently seen the release from one of the two presidential candidates of her initiative on technology and innovation. Now, we could do a whole show or two or three about every point that is raised in this document that was published by the Hillary Clinton campaign. We're not going to do that. We're not going to try and recap it for you. I'm just going to highlight for our listeners and viewers that it exists, and mention if you want a cheat sheet to everything that we have discussed on the show this week, go to tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw. And all of our discussion points for episode 351 and every other episode, you'll find them there. But on the topic of the DMCA, there is a copyright section here that I think it's worth bringing up. Number one, to ask everyone on the panel if they think, you know, how they think this letter to Congress jibes with what at least one presidential candidate. Oh, and I'll just mention, I would point you toward Donald Trump's technology and innovation agenda, but it doesn't exist yet. So stay tuned for that. I'm sure at some point we will see something from him, but it's not out there in the wild at the moment. Mrs. Clinton, Secretary Clinton, has some smart people, it seems like, she's consulting with on this. There's a lot of detail. And in particular, here, I'll just read you the copyright part, which is full of some good nuggets for folks who followed this show. Some things I was surprised to see in there, pleased to see in there. Copyrights encourage creativity and incentivize innovators to invest knowledge, time, and money into the generation of myriad forms of content. However, the copyright system has languished for many decades and is in need of administrative reform to maximize its benefits in the digital age. So you might find Hillary Clinton in the camp of, hey, maybe we should be revisiting some of these laws. Hillary believes the federal government should modernize the copyright system by unlocking and facilitating access to orphan works that languished unutilized, benefiting neither their creators nor the public. She will also promote open licensing arrangements for copyrighted material and data supported by federal grant funding, including in education, science, and other fields. She will seek to develop technological infrastructure to support digitization, search, and repositories of such content to facilitate its discoverability and use. And she will encourage stakeholders to work together on creative solutions that remove barriers to the seamless and efficient licensing of content in the U.S. and abroad.
And there's also one more sentence that found itself in the defend net neutrality section, but for maybe questionable reasons. But she also maintains her opposition to policies that unnecessarily restrict the free flow of data online, such as the high-profile fight over the Stop Online Piracy Act. So that's another copyright thing that kind of found itself in the net neutrality section. But yeah.
Right, right. So she's got stuff on patents. She's got lots of stuff about access and broadband. And so I encourage folks to check this out. There's a lot here to unpack. But just in that particular paragraph seemed to resonate with what we were discussing about whether it's possible to update our copyright laws to make sense in the current age. She doesn't seem as pessimistic about that as I might be. And and also this notion that of grant funding for open license initiatives, that seems intriguing. Anything else here, Ali, you wanted to call out?
Yeah, so I took some of the stuff about the copyright system to be maybe referring to the Copyright Office and the Copyright Office modernization issue, which is does seem to be, again, a DC perspective, as the one thing that there is a lot of agreement from all sides that it is that the office does need some, there could be some modernization, especially to their IT system. So it's a lot of people agree on the problem. Not everyone agrees on the exact solution, but I do think that if something is going to pass, Copyright Office modernization, a very limited, narrow bill on that could happen. So that's, I kind of looked at it from that lens, that it was more about the office itself and some of the problems that it's facing. And yeah, but I agree there was some stuff in there that was interesting and unexpected about the open licensing and orphan works issues. I know that open licensing, it's a sort of a tangentially related issue to copyright, but there has, I think maybe the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy and some other parts of the government have been committed to making more scholarly works available under an open access regime and often under open licensing, maybe Creative Commons or other kinds of open licensing to prevent these kind of, especially when they're funded by federal grants and then preventing them from being locked up and not available to the public. So yeah, I was pretty impressed. I'm usually pretty, I kind of have a low bar often for what I'm expecting from politicians about copyright and technology policy. And this definitely surpassed what I was expecting. So I was impressed by the specificity and how balanced it was, because doesn't often happen. I know there was actually a former presidential candidate, this kind of long shot, that this this election was Professor Lawrence Lessig, and he had actually had, I will say, he did have some interesting copyright stuff that I agreed with there too. But for a mainstream candidate, I am impressed that the Hillary Clinton campaign put this out. So I'm pleasantly surprised.
The one thing I noticed that's right below the copyright section that she'll take some pushback about from the EFF, I'm sure, and others, is she's got a little paragraph that seems to have been designed to address the FBI versus Apple controversy, called Protect Online Privacy as Well as Security. Hillary rejects the false choice between privacy interests and keeping Americans safe, et cetera, et cetera. Reiterates what she was saying at the time in the middle of that controversy of basically getting Silicon Valley and the government together and figuring this all out somehow in a way that enables law enforcement to have access and protects people's privacy. I think there are a lot of people who think that that's that world that she's envisioning can't exist, but she's going to try, according to this. So any other thoughts before we go back to some sweet, sweet musical type stories? Emery, you want to weigh in on any of the policy stuff?
No, I don't really have anything. I think that Ali covered everything. I think the discussion on the Orphan Works is fascinating. I'm really, really nervous about what she means by rejecting the false choice between privacy interests and keeping Americans safe. That sounds super, super scary, frankly, given her record on that front. But yeah, I'm happy to leave Trainwreck 2016 to other guests to talk about.
Okay. Yes. Would that we, I think as a country, had more optimism about the coming election. But
yeah,
it is what it is. I guess back once again to the Churchill quote. Yes. Let's put quoting Churchill as our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. And let's stick with the DMCA and talk about Capitol Records versus Vimeo, a case that is sort of the other shoe dropping on the pre-1972 sound recording discussions that we've had recently on the show. In this case, it was basically determined that the DMCA safe harbor is going to be available for, in this case, Vimeo and then others in its kind of business model situation to protect them when pre-1972 sound recordings are posted to the site. Ali, you want to tell us more about this?
Yeah, sure. So I will say that CCI filed a brief in support of Vimeo in this case, so definitely not an unbiased person. I do think that the Second Circuit got it right. I think that the EFF post did a really helpful way of, that you just had on the screen, did a good job at breaking down the major issues. Most importantly, that the DMCA safe harbor is available, even though pre-72 sound recordings are protected by state law, as Mike was discussing earlier. They put in the quote from the court that it's for reasons not easily understood, just showing that the whole reason for everything being protected by state law and then federal law is pretty confusing. And then they notably did rejected the Copyright Office's interpretation about the safe harbor applying. And so that was a pretty important thing. A lot of times courts can be deferential to the Copyright Office, but in this case they were clear that they did a statutory argument analysis and that they do apply, which is definitely important. As I was saying earlier, the 512 safe harbors are really important for economic and user reasons. So that it was really encouraging that because there have been a lot more of these cases. There's been a lot of litigation over the last couple of years about pre-72 sound recordings with rights holders going after different services. So this is hopefully will provide some more certainty. I don't know if it's going to discourage more litigation on this front, but and then there were some rulings about the red flag knowledge issue and willful blindness. I think this was an important case. Hopefully other courts will kind of follow suit with the Second Circuit on this important issue.
I haven't read the Second Circuit decision yet, but was just wondering if anyone knows, you or Mike or Emery, how the court addressed the sort of time travel issue in the case that DMCA did not exist at the time, and state law might be the only applicable thing for these recordings. How did it address that?
I can read from the EFF article that quotes the opinion if you'd like.
Thank you. But yes, that would be wonderful.
essentially, they said that the pre-1972 argument belied the policy goal of the DMCA, specifically, quote, to construe Section 512C as leaving service providers subject to liability under state copyright laws for postings by users of infringements of which the service providers were unaware would defeat the very purpose Congress sought to achieve in passing the statute. Service providers could be compelled either to incur heavy costs of monitoring every posting to be sure it did not contain pre-1972 recordings, or incurring potentially crushing liabilities under state copyright laws. It's not as if pre-1972 sound recordings were sufficiently outdated as to render the potential liabilities insignificant.
Right. Okay. Well, I think that sounds like a good job by the Second Circuit. Anybody else want to weigh in further on Capitol Records versus Vimeo?
You know, it's a,
go ahead.
It's an opinion written by Pierre Laval of the Second Circuit, and you know, he's written a lot of influential decisions over the years. If folks haven't read it, it's actually a really great read, interesting, and I think, as always with Judge Laval, the analysis. You may disagree with it, but it's very thoroughly done and well put together judicial opinion.
Good. I will definitely keep it on my to-do list. Let's talk about the streaming services and what's going on with them. Specifically in the news lately has been Spotify not being happy with Apple. Apple saying that Spotify is violating its developer guidelines, Spotify firing back that no, this whole notion that we should have to be vetted by you who are a competitor in the same field smacks of antitrust, unfairly anti-competitive conduct. Allie, what's your take on this spat?
Yeah, so my association does not represent Spotify or Apple, so don't take my position to be any comments on the individual companies or the industry. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I do think that it is always interesting when kind of competition issues come into play. I know that they mentioned both US and EU competition law. There's actually been a lot of competition issues happening in the EU lately. We do have CCIA has a Brussels office of four lawyers, and they do seem to be really busy on competition and copyright and their overlap over there too. But yeah, I think that this seems to be, I kind of understand both sides' position on this. It seems like they're kind of narrowly reading Apple's guidelines. But I do understand why Spotify didn't want to charge their customers more than they could otherwise, because Apple takes the cut. So I understand why Spotify wants to encourage users to sign up for the paid version outside of Apple's ecosystem. I will say that I'm an Android user, so I'm not as familiar with a lot of how the Apple ecosystem works. I know there's a lot of Apple has a lot of control over things, and definitely has some. I think it's more complex and harder to get stuff in Apple's App Store than maybe the Android App Store. But I do hope that they can kind of work out these issues and make sure that the users have the newest version and are able to stream all the music that they like. Because it is interesting because Apple both has their own music service and that they have the App Store that a lot of users use. So it is an interesting issue that I hadn't been following before this. So I'm glad that you guys flagged it, and I'm curious to see what the rest of you think.
again, yeah, I think it's a really interesting issue, and that in Apple's favor, if it does come under antitrust sort of scrutiny here, is that certainly Spotify is not the only company that it's hard on in meeting App Store requirements. It's sort of notorious for that. And that's just right. How they have decided to run their App Store. And, you know, they're allowed to do that. You know, if they want to have certain onerous requirements that developers have to meet, I think they could pretty competently make the case that they apply that standard across the board, mm-hmm. Which I think would be helpful in combating these kinds of claims. I can understand, you know, why Spotify would get twisted up about this, but Spotify, as you point out, Ali, I think it would be hard for Spotify to make the case that Apple has the monopoly in app distribution. You know, the Android universe is huge. You can access Spotify in any number of ways that don't involve using an iOS app. So I just don't know that there's that much to discuss here. Mike, any thoughts?
No, I have no nothing to contribute on this topic.
Okay. I threw in, since we were talking about Apple and Spotify, the rumor that Apple is looking to buy Tidal, if anyone's interested in discussing that and further rumor mongering, now would be the time to weigh in on that. Going, anyone?
I got nothing on that.
All right.
I can't believe people are still talking about Tidal.
Yeah. I'd like to see more competition and rather than more consolidation. So yeah. It would be great if there were more music services. It would also be great just if music was less fragmented and balkanized across a lot of different services. But if a lot of artists are going to have exclusives on different services, there are other ways that some services have been kind of competing in different ways by having other features for artists, whether it's kind of a more social issue or social feature, or Spotify's Discover Weekly and running features. I do think it's an interesting rumor and I'm curious to see what happens. But yeah, I would like to see more competition, not less, in music services for the benefit of the services, the artists, and the users. It really benefits everyone to have more services. So.
As Bob Lefsetz pointed out in the Lefsetz letter, this I thought was an interesting little tidbit to bring up on the show. He unpacked something called the Buzz Angle mid-year report that monitors, among other things, the sheer volume of audio streams versus video streams. And in this report, audio streams beat video streams. There were 114 trillion, I believe that is, audio streams. And 95 trillion video streams. That's the billions column.
Really high trillions. Numbers, really high.
Yes, trillion seemed pretty high. So audio beating video seems to be a good indicator that, that's, you know, the Spotify oriented. Apple Music, et cetera, streaming services, beating YouTube and video, Vimeo and everyone else for how much is being streamed.
So where are we on that list? Are we the audio streams? Are podcasts audio streams on that? That was my only question, because I know that, you know, 2015 was a huge podcasting year. So I would think that, you know, Undisclosed might have boosted those numbers last year, if nothing else.
Right. I think we're both because we make the show available in audio only for people who want that. And then we also offer the high def and standard def video versions of the show. So I think we see the numbers on both sides.
Yeah. I disagreed with the author of the letter, though, just because he seemed to say that YouTube was his argument was just that video was a terrible place to watch, a terrible way to watch or listen to music. And as evidence here, you know, there are more audio streams than video streams, but I think that it doesn't necessarily take into account all the non-music audio streaming that people are doing and all the non-video streaming that video streaming people are doing.
Yep, good point.
Exactly. There's a lot more competition for your ears and your eyes than ever before. I mean, I think I know that I personally have been on a major podcast kick over the last year. I think a lot more of the time I'm listening to podcasts than music. And I think that there are a lot of different things that people can do for entertainment and education. And yeah, if music listening is in some way declining, it doesn't mean that it's the fault of different services. It could just be that it's because people's tastes change and people want to listen to some people talk in their ears and teach them something sometimes. And sometimes they want to listen to music. And so there are a lot of other factors and a lot of competition for people's attention. So it is an interesting point that Emery raises.
I want to come back in a moment and ask our panelists about payola in the world of streaming music. But before we do that, I'd like to thank our second sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, and that is Wealthfront. You invest for the long term for you or your family's financial health, but trying to do it yourself, especially the right way, is complex and time consuming. Luckily, there's Wealthfront. Traditional advisors charge huge fees between 1% and 3% of what they manage. With Wealthfront, you pay 0.25% a year. That's 25 basis points, zero commissions, and no hidden fees. That's less than $5 a month to invest a $30,000 account. There are no additional charges for any of Wealthfront's services. You can get started today investing as little as $500. Unlike other financial advisors, Wealthfront won't bog you down with dozens of questions. They've simplified their risk identification process, which allows you to begin investing sooner. It only takes a few minutes to sign up at Wealthfront.com. It goes right to work, monitoring your portfolios around the clock, and takes action as soon as an opportunity arises. Wealthfront portfolios are based on modern portfolio theory and are designed to adjust according to your personal risk tolerance while staying diversified and tax efficient. Wealthfront is transparent and accessible. You can view and track all your accounts in one place. Wealthfront can track both your Wealthfront and non-Wealthfront bank and brokerage accounts, and they'll provide a summary of all your assets. You can see every trade that Wealthfront makes on your behalf in your dashboard, on your desktop, or with their mobile app. Wealthfront recently introduced their 529 college savings plan, allowing you to invest after-tax dollars, much like a Roth IRA, and save for your child or your grandchild's higher education expenses. Wealthfront manages almost $3 billion in client assets, and it's growing rapidly every day. So what are you waiting for? Invest in your future today. And if you're not saving, you really need to be taking a look at Wealthfront to make sure that you're taking care of your future, whether it's a short-term goal, a longer-term goal like a 529 college savings plan, your retirement needs, all of that. Wealthfront is a great way to go. You can visit wealthfront.com/twill to sign up and get your free personalized investment portfolio. You'll see the customized allocation they recommend for your profile. And just for Twit listeners, if you sign up to invest, Wealthfront will manage your first $15,000 entirely free of charge for life. Join the many Twit fans who have seen huge success with Wealthfront and claim your offer today at wealthfront.com/twill. Thank you so much, Wealthfront, for your support of This Week in Law. All right, so if streaming audio is eclipsing streaming video, and the streaming services are really becoming, at least if not surpassing, radio services, a direct competitor to them and something that is, you know, equally as mainstream as conventional terrestrial radio or satellite radio have been, do we need to start worrying about pay-for-play kind of arrangements? Ali, what do you think the status of that is right now?
I will say it's not something that I hear people talk about a lot, but that doesn't mean it's this kind of stuff isn't happening in shady backroom deals that aren't transparent to the public. But I don't know if I would see that this would happen any more than it used to. It is an interesting point, though, when the industry changes and user listening habits and preferences change. I guess it's possible that there will be some motivation to do that. But yeah, that's not something that I've heard a lot about or really thought about. So I'm curious to see what other people think.
Denise, right. Are you referring specifically to payola in kind of the traditional context of paying or providing benefits for playing songs on commercial radio? Is that?
Yeah, I'm referring to that, and also the fact that when you start using an online service and incorporating algorithms, the selection process might be more subtle. One of our listeners actually wrote in, and I don't know if he had a tinfoil hat on at the time or not, but was wondering about, was just sort of speculating that, for example, using the random or shuffle settings in one of these services would be a great way to sort of hide the fact that some tracks were being promoted without disclosing that. And my thought back to him was, you know, I certainly don't know or haven't read about services being accused about that, accused of that. But it makes me want to revisit the terms of service of some of these services, as lengthy and agonizing as that can be, to see if there's language hiding in there that would protect them in that kind of situation. That if you're letting us select your track list and what we deliver to you, what kind of latitude the services have to put things in that aren't just algorithmically generated songs. So it was just something that caught my attention. I wondered if you guys had any thoughts.
Go ahead, Allie.
No, you can go first.
So as I understand it, the statute that deals with payola, at least my understanding is it deals with kind of traditional radio broadcasts. I don't know if it applies, and Allie or Emery, maybe you have insight into this. Does the prohibition regarding payola, does it apply to an online streaming service as well?
Yeah, that's a good fundamental question. I don't know the answer to.
Yeah,
I remember I worked at a radio station in our undergrad at KELSU 91.1 Baton Rouge, and it was a nonprofit 501c3. So I know that certainly for those kind of organizations, payola schemes would not be kosher. And I heard that we never got offered money to pay, and we never got paid to play any music. We just got music to play. But no, it's a great question.
Yeah, on the question of different laws being applied to broadcast radio versus streaming services, and often a lot of the broadcast players have their own streaming services now too. It's true that the laws often apply differently to different technological services, which is not a great thing for competition, in my view. One of a disco posts from a few years ago, I think it's called Why Internet Radio Has a Bad Deal. I think that's what it was. And it kind of looks at the different, there's a couple of different standards of what all the services pay because in terms of royalty rates, because a lot of the services that existed at the time, several decades ago, they were kind of grandfathered into paying one standard, there's a few other different kind of standards. It's music licensing can get really complicated, but that they pay different amounts. And so that is kind of one reason why it can be really hard to get into the music streaming business, because so many of these services are paying out often more than they take in from advertising and from subscription fees, because the royalty rates can be really costly. And but one other thing I will note, maybe for another time, but the Department of Justice has been looking into these consent decrees with the PROs ASCAP and BMI, and we're hearing that they're going to be putting out something. They've been looking at them for the past couple of years. We're hearing from some sources, often it looks like a lot of them have been leaked from the publishing industry, that there might be. They might be putting out a statement soon. We're hearing that they might not change things, which would be good for competition and for services. It's another intersection between antitrust law and copyright law. And the consent decrees have been kind of put into place to prevent kind of shady behavior by a lot of these different stakeholders. So it's not, I don't think Paola would be part of that, but there are a bunch of different regulations that have been really important at encouraging competition and kind of discouraging this kind of collusion, which does happen anyways. So maybe another topic for another time, but there are a lot of interesting things happening in the music copyright and competition worlds. So.
Right. And then I don't know that this may be a little far afield. I can't really identify. Well, maybe I can identify legal ramifications of this. I could certainly see eventually someone like Taylor Swift getting upset about the fact that it's happening. But one unintended consequence of certain artists taking a stance and saying, we're not going to be on Spotify because we don't think that it's friendly enough to artists. We don't think it's encouraging enough to in the way that it pays out to artists, is the fact that there are other less well-known artists who think that it's encouraging enough for them to come in and do covers of people like Taylor Swift. So what this means is if you go on Spotify and search for Taylor Swift songs, you're not going to find any of her music, but you're going to find a lot of people covering her. Same thing with Adele and others. And some of those artists who are doing the covers are getting lots and lots of plays and kind of it's helping advance their own careers. We have a couple of examples we can play for you. Same listener who I mentioned earlier wrote in and let me know about someone called Anthem Lights. So let's see what they are up to on Spotify.
I was crying on the staircase, begging you please don't go, 'cause you belong.
If you could see that I'm the one who understands, you've been here all along, so why can't you see me? You belong with me.
So these guys are obviously quite good. At least I find them good. I could just sort of chill out and listen to them for the rest of the show. So they're getting plays, they're getting recognition, et cetera, as an unintended consequence of the fact that Taylor Swift has yanked her music off that service. Another artist named Jocelyn Schofield had a similar event. She has a Skyfall cover on Spotify that has an enormous number of listens. And again, she is quite good. And that explains it. We could show a bit of her.
Hold your breath and come to ten. Feel the earth move and then hear my heart burst again. For this is.
Okay, thanks, Victor. So, Allie, I thought this would be of good interest to you. You are a singer and do covers as well. Is this encouraging you to start covering folks who have pulled themselves off of streaming services and start uploading your work?
Yeah, especially because I wouldn't have to give any money to any other kind of intermediary. If I did the licensing in the right way and the artist got the composer got paid, but I would be kind of curious to see how that just from a kind of this perspective, just knowing how much you actually do get paid from the streaming services and when people are searching for your songs. I have found this, I know people use Spotify a lot more. I have put up some covers on SoundCloud and some of them have been played a lot of times. I also make mine available for download. So I don't know if that means that people stream them less times because then they download them. But so yeah, certain ones that have been in popular movies. I think two of my Taylor Swift ones are my most streamed songs. So that could be because people are searching for the songs because they're not available on certain services. But yeah, I do think that this is a really interesting phenomenon, especially because there are different kinds of licensing startups. Like one that's mentioned often is Louder, L-O-U-D-R, without the E, that make the licensing. I've also heard of other ones like TuneCore, maybe. There are a few of these kinds of licensing services that do all the hard work of getting the whether it's a compulsory license or actually getting permission and just taking care of all the legal things so that the music can be uploaded legally and quickly, and the artist, the song, singer can start to get paid. So yeah, I think it's great. Yeah.
Ali, Mike, this is for both of you, I guess, and for our listeners that might not be as aware of the intricacies of licensing and music copyright, but could you guys go into a little depth about the background on cover songs, mechanical licensing, mandatory licenses? Why is it that cover artists can go out and make these songs that I think many, you know, the general public would probably consider to be infringing?
Yeah, Ali, you want to explain that? Well, so I actually had a question related to exactly what Emery's talking about. So as I understand and obviously music licensing is so incredibly complex, but you would need in order to cover a Taylor Swift song or an Adele song, you would need a compulsory license, right? To be able to actually record it. But then don't you need a separate license to also make an audiovisual work that incorporates the song?
That's not covered by the
mechanical license, right?
And that is the mechanical license.
You would need, but there are two different types of licenses that you would need in order to do what those artists just did, right?
I think that's right, where there are a few different. So the compulsory license, it's a statutory license where.
Means, by the way, for our listeners, that you are always able to get it. There's statutorily you are able to get this kind of license.
Exactly.
It's not up to the artist to decide whether or not they want to sell this license to you. You are, because it's statutorily guaranteed to you, you can get it. Sorry, go on, Ali.
But importantly, Emery, that only covers a sound recording, though, right? The fixation of the sounds on a disc or digitally or otherwise. It doesn't license you to go out and make a video. Isn't that right, Ali?
I think that's right. It is true that there's copyright is a bundle of rights where we have the public performance right, we have the right to make derivative works, the right to reproduce, the right to distribute. And so these are the different copyrights. And then there's also these different types of licenses that have kind of become industry norms, and there are different kinds of entities like Harry Fox and a few other different types of entities that will often just take care of licensing and one of these individual parts of the bundle. And so it's true that there are a few that it's music copyright gets really complicated. So yeah, there are ways to do the, to lawfully acquire these licenses and get your music out there fast, but it can require a service. Hopefully it doesn't require an army of lawyers for your like one song. I do think the services themselves, it's a lot more complex. They often have to do direct deals. They can't always rely just on the individual licenses, and then it's different whether it's a non-interactive service that's more like radio, like Pandora, or an interactive service where you can choose a song on demand, like Spotify. There's a lot of different types of licenses and different types of complicated rules. And so a lot of times, a lot of lawyers are necessary, and that makes things even more complex and more expensive often. So yeah, it does seem that there are services that take care of some of the cover song licensing to make sure that this stuff independent artists who want to record a cover and get it up on Spotify and other services, they do help with that. But yeah, I'm a lawyer, and I still feel like I would use one of these services because it's just so, when I do ultimately put my song on streaming services, because it is really complex.
Yeah, I hadn't heard of Louder before, but I'm sure there's a great market for that kind of service. Victor in the studio has a good example of why someone might also be motivated to do a cover. He knows some folks who did a Justin Bieber cover on YouTube and got noticed and became his backup singers on tour. Oh. So they're called Legacy, apparently.
Interesting.
Yeah. So it's a big wide world out there full of opportunity for up and coming artists.
Yeah, they're probably... They were probably a good one example of it going really good for somebody putting up covers on YouTube. And they, I mean, it was a long road for them. I knew them a long time ago, and I mean, it took them a while to get that type of notice. And
they doing covers on YouTube. Yeah. He himself was made from YouTube, right? Didn't he record covers? And he was discovered. So yeah, I think it's been a really great great tool for artists and for getting their music out there. So yeah, it can really have a lot of impact when you're talented, and it can help you find fans and build a career, whether it's a mainstream artist or kind of there's just a lot of different types of careers than there used to be. I don't know. For artists like that you mentioned, like Anthem Lights and other kinds of artists that might do more covers, or a lot of these acapella groups that can do really well online too. It is really interesting the types of groups that have been able to make it online, doing kind of really creative takes on other people's works in addition to their own original songs.
All right, in a moment, we're going to get to our end of the show material, including our animal selfies of the week and our tip of the week and resource of the week. But we're going to thank our final sponsor for the show first, and that is FreshBooks. Small business owners, it's time to be honest about how you feel when dealing with your day-to-day administrative work. Admit it, you can't stand it. It's a total grind. The truth is, over 5 million small business owners felt exactly the same way until they discovered FreshBooks. FreshBooks is the dead simple cloud accounting software that's transforming how small business owners handle their paperwork. For invoicing, you can use FreshBooks to create and send an invoice literally in about 30 seconds. There are no formulas or formatting. There are just perfectly crafted invoices every single time. You can also brand your invoices, set recurring invoices, and attach receipts. Your clients can pay you online, which often means that you end up getting paid a lot faster. With FreshBooks, you can set auto payment reminders and snap photos of your receipts to be able to include in those invoices. There's a super handy deposit feature. You can also invoice for a payment up front when you're kicking off a project. You can also import expenses automatically. FreshBooks can even show you whether or not a client has looked at the invoice that you've emailed. This is only a fraction of what FreshBooks can do for you. You owe it to yourself to feel the full effect of FreshBooks on you and your small business. Also, check out their EMV chip card-enabled card reader. Getting started is simple, and it's totally free for 30 days. Go to freshbooks.com/twill, and don't forget to enter This Week in Law in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Start your 30-day free trial today. Thank you so much, FreshBooks, for your support of This Week in Law. All right, at least some of our we are about to present you with our animal selfies of the week. And at least some of them are homegrown. For those of you who might be wondering why we talk about animal selfies on a legal show, is that animal selfies have turned into a delightful little subgenre of copyright law.
Next week when we have AI lawyers on the show, we've talked about the sort of idea of algorithms and copyright before. And Idea Channel just brought up the relationship between the monkey selfie and the copyrightability of algorithms and AI and stuff just recently. So yeah, I think it fits on perfectly, and it was my idea, so that's why.
There we go. All good reasons. And so I've decided to contribute personally to our store of animal selfies that we're highlighting on the show. Over the couple of weeks, I promised you stories about what I did on my summer vacation. One thing I did on my summer vacation was commune with a sheep in England. In fact, the first photo, we were visiting an area in England where there were many sheep, and I was actually traveling with my son's school, and one of his classmates was running around going, "I've got to get a sheep selfie." And I went, "I've got to get a sheep selfie." So I did. So we have that for you. And then later on in my travels, we were in a completely different part of the world, but it was once a British colony. We were down in the Bahamas, and a shark selfie ensued. So have that for you. And then finally, and here's the one that might have the most interesting copyright discussion associated with it, because I actually got a selfie of, or or captured a selfie being taken by, again, that's just tongue in cheek, Jimmy Buffett's lost shaker of salt, which I'm including here only because we had a mostly music-oriented show today. All of those from my recent travels. And then should you be traveling to Saskatchewan, please do not take a selfie with the Saskatchewan Lake Moose. Apparently they have a moose swimming around in the lake in Saskatchewan, and people are trying to get too close to it so that they can photograph themselves with it. Not a good idea. They're very large and unpredictable animals. Those would be our animal selfies of the week. Our tip of the week is to let you know if you are hoping to make and release a Star Trek fan film that CBS and Paramount have released their fan film guidelines. Sadly, they're somewhat disappointing. They don't really do much good for the folks at Axanar since
disappointing is a funny way of pronouncing the word awful.
Yes. Yes, it is. Basically, Axanar is not something that could be made under these guidelines. And really anything, what is it? They have to be 15 minutes long, or if you do two episodes, not more than a total of 30 minutes.
Family friendly, no nudity, no profanity, no synthol.
Synthahol,
yeah. Right.
Or yeah, no, it's not very friendly for fan films, but they are out there, as you can see in the background, the Axanar teaser trailer for the feature film, which they plan on going forward with. So
I don't know how that's going to happen. I mean, yeah, they plan on going forward with this, but yeah, sorry, didn't mean to interrupt you. But yeah, this is what we were, when we brought this up last time, I think I said I was pessimistically cynical or cautiously pessimistically optimistic, maybe. But yeah, I mean, this is exactly why a good, strong, fair use decision needs to come from the courts or Congress, because surprise, surprise, when you leave it up to CBS or Paramount to write their industry guidelines, it's, you know, insane. These are not, you know, guidelines that any fan film could or should follow.
Right.
So disappointing.
I think this means it's time to have Mark Randazza back on the show.
Yes. Yep.
Definitely. All right. Yes. And there's nothing, actually, I didn't see anything in the guidelines. I'll have to take a look about languages that you can or cannot use.
Ah.
Yes. Which is the Mark Randazza amicus brief issue.
Can you use
issue.
Profanity in another language?
Ah, an even better, question. Sure. Cursing and Klingon. All right. We have a couple of great resources of the week for you. Number one, if you are in London or New York, Joshua Browder, who will be on the show with us next week, has developed an amazing tool that has a 60% success rate in challenging parking tickets. So, Emery, have you looked at this? Do you know how this thing works exactly?
I mean, I don't know exactly how. I'm not a programmer, mm-hmm. but I can tell you the gist of it is that he has a chatbot, just like plenty of the chatbots that we are all familiar with, where you sort of talk at them and they sort of respond to you based on what you say. Except this chatbot has a really awesome purpose, and Joshua, the enterprising, intelligent young kid that he is, created this chatbot that automates the process of challenging parking tickets. Josh has said that he sees people that are victims of parking tickets as a really victimized class of people. They're sort of facing the, you know, monstrosity that is bureaucracy to challenge these things that they, you know, likely never intended to break the law in the first place. So I think it's really cool. A hint of what is to come down the pike from the AI lawyers. But yeah, I am so excited to have Joshua, and we're also going to have some guys from Ross on the show next week as well. So very excited about next week. Stay tuned and check out Chatbot if you happen to be in London, or I think NYU maybe also has them.
Yes, New York and London is what he's developed from. And according to the Ars Technica article, and we'll ask him more next week, he's also doing a similar chatbot designed to help Arabic-speaking asylum seekers and refugees fill out applications to receive public benefits and other documents.
That's
so
wonderful.
This is right awesome. In line. Cory Doctorow wrote years ago, I forget which book of his it's in, but about a couple of people who had a fender bender and their phones immediately started auto-generating their insurance claims and legal claims against each other via tools just like this. So it's really cool to see it coming into existence. Our other resource of the week is for those in DC, and I'm sure Allie will go, and it is trivia related to internet law and policy. I guess it is the second iteration of the Internet Law and Policy Trivia Night. It's going to be next week, July 11th. In DC, and if you think you have the chops to, it's going to be emceed by, this is from the site, renowned cyber law quizmaster Kurt Upsall, who's been on our show before, and he is the deputy executive director and general counsel of the EFF, and presides over, incidentally, EFF's famed cyber law pub trivia. So if you think you know your stuff, get yourself to this event. Allie, are you going to go?
Yes, and not only am I going, but we were the winning team last year.
Nice.
Defend our crown. So I definitely encourage people, if you're in DC, to come to our internet trivia on Monday. And also just to learn more about the Internet Law and Policy Foundry anyway. I know some of my fellows were on This Week in Law
recently, like within
ago.
The last
couple
months.
Yeah. And here's our awesome logo, Internet Law and Policy Foundry. But I encourage checking out our website. We have a really great job board of a lot of different internet and technology law and policy jobs and internships. That kind of continues a project I'd started a few years ago. And so, I look into getting more involved. We have a lot of great events, a blog. We're going to be taking applications for fellows and members this summer. So look into it. And I'm happy to answer questions about it. But I think a lot of listeners to This Week in Law might be interested in checking out the Internet Law and Policy Foundry.
Oh, I know they would be. And that's some bragging rights right there, Allie. Congratulations.
Thank you.
How deep is your team? How deep is your bench?
We have a bunch of lawyers here who specialize in a lot of different tech topics. So we have copyright experts, privacy, telecom, trade, and antitrust. There actually was a whole round on music copyright and sampling cases last year, and I think that we won by like a half a point or a point. And so I think that our getting that round and my help on that round definitely helped us win. So hopefully there might even be another round on these interesting music copyright issues again. So we'll see.
Cool. Well, we're so delighted that you could come and discuss them with us here today. It's great to see you again. We hope to see you again sometime in the not too near future on This Week in Law. It's been just wonderful chatting with you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. And while you mentioned Monkey Selfie, I wanted to show off my little desk toys. I have a 3D printed, I don't know where to put it. I have my Monkey Selfie, and I also have my Left Shark. So Monkey Selfie is a 5-year-old controversy now. I saw something on Boing Boing about it from Cory Doctorow. Huh. It's pretty crazy. Yeah. It feels like it was just yesterday that everyone was freaking out about this Monkey Selfie. I know that PETA still was trying to do some stuff with it. But yeah, I got my little 3D printed controversial animal.
Can you put this up to the camera once more?
Yeah, okay.
There we go. Naruto.
Oh, cool.
Shark.
I'm not good at this.
Feather forever.
That's awesome.
There you go.
That is awesome. I encountered someone in my travels in a Left Shark t-shirt, and I almost gave him a hug.
That's the selfie you need.
Yes, exactly. All right. Mike, great chatting with you again.
As always, a pleasure to be with everybody. And Allie, thank you. It was a great conversation today.
Yeah, thank you so much to all of you. You guys it's been really great talking about these issues with you, and hope to do it again sometime for sure.
Definitely. And Emery, the house hunt continues, I understand.
Yeah, the house hunt continues. This weekend, though, I think I'm going to go outside and play some Pokemon Go. And
That's outside?
Yeah. Also this weekend. I just came out a couple days ago. I haven't gotten a chance to leave my apartment to do anything about it. So
You sound like this, like Pokemon Go is something you would be playing in an open field. That's not how I understand it, is it?
Oh, it's like a smartphone game, Android, iPhone.
Right.
You throw Pokeballs.
But I think that I've seen people posting pictures outside, so I don't know how it works. I think it actually might be
it's some kind of like geocaching type thing.
Okay.
Yeah, you go to different places.
Oh, I like it.
It's all over my Twitter right now, so I've got to go play it. And then also sort of interesting and totally unrelated to this is people that are interested in Bitcoin might want to pay attention this weekend. The Bitcoin halving is going on, which is sure to be interesting, and no one knows what's going to happen. So might be interesting to check out if you're interested in that kind of thing.
Absolutely. And we in upcoming show notes, we've definitely got IP ramifications of Brexit on our plate as well. So stay tuned for that kind of thing. And also for more, as I mentioned at the top of the show, on automated weapons systems and apparently police having RoboCop systems in place and in play, which we just saw last night. So as always, lots to discuss, lots of upcoming things to discuss. We're so glad that you have all been able to join us here today. We do the show every Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. We do it for a couple hours. And if you can make the time to join us live, we would love to have you. You can jump in IRC with us at irc.twit.tv. But if you can't make the show when we record it, you can find all our shows available at the Twit site. twit.tv/twill is where you'll find our archive. We're also on YouTube, available on Roku, on iTunes, et cetera, et cetera. Our Twit page will tell you all of the different ways that you can enjoy the show at your convenience, inside or outside, however you would like. So we're just thrilled that you've been able to join us. Thanks so much for doing so. Get in touch with us between the shows, please. We are Denise, Mike, and Emery, respectively, at twit.tv. So write to us there and let us know what's on your mind, random thoughts that you may have about streaming services or other things. We love to hear about it. It definitely helps us think about things that we might not have before, put things in context, let us know about topics you'd like us to cover, guests you'd like us to invite, all that good stuff. We'd love to hear from you. You can also do that by @ing us on Twitter or hitting us up on Facebook or Google+ as well. So just thrilled to have been here today. Great to be back. The travel was great, but it's wonderful to be back here doing the show with you all. And we will be here again next week on This Week in Law. Until then, take care.